This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, why are Americans so obsessed with guns? Mumia Abu-Jamal explores the genocidal roots of U.S. gun culture. And a Black radical movement put one of its own in the mayor's office in Jackson, Mississippi. But does winning elections actually bring power to the people? Not necessarily, says activist Kelly Okuno.
But first, much of the world was shocked by reports on CNN that Black Africans are being sold at auction in Libya, where the United States and NATO overthrew the government of Muammar Gaddafi 6 years ago. We spoke with Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and reparations.
I would feel a lot better about believing anything that the United States government said about slavery, its concern about slavery, if it would simply do something like pay reparations to African people who it enslaved. It has never even apologized for slavery. So there's no reason that anybody can believe that there's anything that's honest coming from the United States regarding its intent, its motives when it wants to talk about slavery in Libya. I really think that has to be the ground floor that we start on when we listen to this great concern being demonstrated by politicians from the United States about the issue of slavery, even by news media, corporate news media. They know more about slavery than anybody, more than about slavery than Libyans or anybody else, because what has happened here and because our people still pay the consequence of that enslavement. In fact, in many ways, still suffer from a lack of the ability to have self-determination, which is what slavery does, absolutely, is take away the right for self-determination. So I just wanted to say that. But beyond that, obviously, this whole question of slavery is something that was brought to us by a Black man, by an African whose name was Barack Hussein Obama. Of course, he didn't bring slavery to it, and he didn't do what he did by himself. He was an instrument of U.S. imperialist policy. He may have even contributed to creating that policy, but it was under Obama and Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State, that the attack on Libya occurred, that destroyed the Libyan government, that facilitated the rise of these reactionary entities in Libya and outside of Libya, who were opposed to anything that approximated democracy and rights. And also Gaddafi, who was the leader of that government in Libya, was the person who was talking about the United States of Africa and had created one of the most democratic entities, and certainly provided more in terms of the material interests of the people than any state on the continent of Africa. So the United States government cannot be some kind of honest bystander or broker or somebody reporting on this. It created the conditions that exist in Libya right now. And what we're seeing is a product of U.S. imperialist policy.
Yes, many of us remember that the all-Black city of Tuwerga, which had about 40,000 people in residence, was totally destroyed by U.S.-backed militias back in the summer of 2011.
Indeed. And what we saw was not only that attack, that bombing and destruction, but it was something that occurred throughout Libya. And of course, we saw the lynching of Gaddafi, which was incredibly cruel and something that the U.S. imperialists wanted everybody in the world to see. Like Mike Brown out for 4.5 hours. This is exemplary kind of white power justice. This is what can happen to you, too. But yes, the U.S. played, again, the critical role in raising up these anti-Black forces in Libya. And what we're seeing are the consequences of that. So if you create a situation such as what they have created in Libya, then what we're looking at is normal. And I think that's part of the ruse, is to create this and then hold it up as this great evil and as further evidence of why Libya itself was horrible and why Libya had to be destroyed. And what they do is use the situation that they've created as evidence of why it was right for them to have attacked Libya, which in its heyday was opposed to the very same forces that have come to power now that's imposing this slave situation there.
And of course, the United States moved immediately from Libya to Syria in 2011 and backed jihadists who attempted to overthrow the government there. Those jihadists are now on the back foot, as they say, losing the battle militarily. But the United States says that it has no intention of getting out of Syria anytime soon and claims that it has a right, an international mandate from the UN, to be in Syria.
Yeah, a mandate from the United Nations. I really think what's really important for us to remember is that it was the U.S. and all of the imperial forces, particularly those connected to the Middle East, that were on the back foot. That with this sudden, unexpected thing that they call the Arab Spring, with what happened in Tunisia and that overturned that reactionary regime, at least temporarily. And then after Tunisia, when Egypt fell, which was really something that scared the hell out of them, what we saw beginning to emerge was a reconfiguration of the political forces, political regime there in the Middle East. And the U.S. saw Israel becoming much more exposed as a consequence of that, and to sort of tilt the playing field more in its favor, they immediately assaulted Syria. They even tried Iran, and the Iran beat them back, crushed them, because they wanted to create these sometimes sleeper cells and sometimes any kind of incident to establish the basis for supporting the oppressed people in these different places. So the attack Libya was something that also had to fall as a consequence. Otherwise, we had a very isolated, reactionary, white nationalist, Jewish, fascist type state there. And so that was part of what Libya, one of the reasons Libya, Syria, Iran, all of these forces had to be neutralized to the extent that was possible. And that also extends today to some extent what we see happening in Yemen. All of that, that's still unsettled. And we know what has happened up to now with Egypt in terms of the people having some kind of confidence, some kind of faith in the Egyptian military, which was supported and funded forever by the United States government. And we are seeing Syria now still in the crosshairs. They're still concerned, and rightfully so, about Israel being exposed to various forces because it is a reactionary finger in the eye of the Arab people and anybody who's interested in genuine freedom and democracy. So, yeah, Syria, they plan to be in Syria forever if they can do that, if they can. And they would have by now have made a much greater offensive against the Syria itself had it not been for the Russians, which brings us in many ways to the whole discussion that's going on about Russia up until now, because Russia is sort of evened the playing field and made it impossible for the U.S. to have its way as it would have done without Russian intervention.
The U.S. seems to be having its way most of the time, however, in Africa. The overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi's government in Libya was heralded as the first big victory for AFRICOM. And now AFRICOM has agreements with all but two governments on the continent.
Yeah, in many ways, I think this may turn out to be a very positive thing in the sense that many people were actually believed that these were independent actors, these heads of state on the continent of Africa who have been joined. Well, I almost said joined at the hip, but they're not that, they're not equal, but who have been really minions, that the servants of imperialism. There's not a single one of them that has any kind of independence. There's not a single one of them that could field an army, that could even maintain the government itself without what they like to call as assistance from donors. In other words, imperialist powers, pay their bills, et cetera, all up and down the line. Of course, most of them deny that AFRICOM would ever come to the countries that they preside over. That's because they couldn't admit it because of what they assume would be the rejection, the reaction to masses of people to know that this was happening. But now, it is clear to more and more of us that the United States, through AFRICOM, is the big dog on the continent of Africa. And it is there, obviously, to maintain the status quo. And the status quo means, in part, maintain neocolonial domination by Europe and America, and more by the U.S., that has, from time to time, even contended with European powers, particularly France, for hegemony on the continent of Africa. And increasingly, what it's meaning is the status quo is being protected from intervention by China, which has muddied up the water somewhat because it's given some of these African heads of state the guts every now and then to try and push back on demands being made by the United States of France, et cetera, assuming that they could play the China card. But yeah, the U.S. is the big dog. AFRICOM is there in no little way. It is there. And I think that what that means is that ultimately, it's going to mean that our enemies are not going to appear as scattered and diffuse as they have appeared in the past. And increasingly, we'll see that it's the United States that we are really facing on the continent of Africa, United States and France, particularly right now. So, yeah, AFRICOM is demonic in terms of the role that is played there. I hate using terms like that, but it's really vicious and it intends to maintain the status quo of impoverishment and oppression for Africa and African people.
Many of us remember when there was something called the frontline state in Africa, those states that were assisting liberation forces to overthrow white rule in South Africa. And many of us thought of those states as the front lines in the fight against U.S. imperialism as well. But there are no frontline states in Africa anymore.
No, and even when we thought there were front line states. In so many ways, they were tenuous. I mean, it was frontline states in the sense that they disapproved of the rule of, say, like Rhodesia that was become Zimbabwe and the South African regimes in Portugal, etc. But it was not that they were opposed to imperialism at all. And in fact, when you look at what's happening now with Zimbabwe, because many people assume incorrectly that something that's happened in Zimbabwe that is a setback for revolution for Africa, you got to remember that it was the frontline states who really pushed and forced and demand ZANU to sign that Lancaster deal, the negotiated settlement that would allow the white people to be there and continue to own the land and to actually share political power despite the fact that they were supposed to be being pushed out. It was the frontline states that told them that if ZANU didn't take that deal, then they were going to have to get out of those countries and fend for themselves. And it was not just ZANU that they pressured that way. They pressured every force that was there. So their opposition was not to imperialism as such. It was to the regimes that were there in the form of the Rhodesian government, the South African government, and then Portugal as it represented itself with these Portuguese colonizer countries there. But you don't even have the pretext. The only thing that might approximate something like that is the possibility that one of these countries thinks it can get a good deal again from China and might try to play China against the U.S. or China against France. And that's never worked up to now for them. They've always caught hell and paid a horrible price for trying to do that. But there's not even an approximation of what there was before with the so-called frontline states.
The U.S. media is full of speculation about who's going to replace Secretary of State Tillerson, who's clearly on the outs with his boss, Donald Trump. The media also claims that under Tillerson, the State Department has been gutted and all of these professional diplomats have been put in the wind. But maybe that's a good thing from the standpoint of the rest of the world, the gutting of the U.S. State Department.
Maybe it is, because many people recognize, and certainly many people in the international community understand, that there's not much difference in the State Department, in the CIA, and various other elements of the U.S. state. And certainly what it has meant in terms of direct and immediate intervention to have these forces in every country. I remember when the Iranian Revolution happened, or when the Iranians seized the embassy in 1979, I think it was, and they characterized this embassy as a nest of spies. And of course, that's what it was. And the embassy, before falling to the Iranians, had shredded tons and tons of documents and what have you. that the Iranians painstakingly pasted all back together. And it helped to just show the depth of U.S. secret police intervention in that country. And that's true everywhere. So to say that the State Department has been gutted, I don't think there's anybody outside of Europe and North America that's going to be shedding any tears about that. I agree that it is probably not a bad thing to see this happen. But again, I do think that this is just a part of a reflection of the death of the crisis of this whole social system of imperialism, even in its most aggressive and most repressive actions, it's functioning as a system in great disrepair. And I think that even what we're seeing with what's happening to Trump's forces, Michael Flynn and others, perhaps, well, Flynn, of course, pleading guilty to lying to the FBI and the sector of the bourgeoisie on the hunt to nail more of Trump administration forces to the same wall and perhaps Trump himself. I think all of this represents the crisis of this damn social system. And Tillerson will not be missed by anybody in the world who is not in bed with U.S. imperialism.
Yes, folks who worry about the State Department believe in the theory that somehow the State Department is for peace and is a counterbalance against the Pentagon, which is for war.
And I guess that's why Hillary was so happy with what happened with Muammar Gaddafi and all the others when she was over the State Department. Of course, all of that is just ridiculous. What's been really interesting is if you watch what's happening with State Departments over the various years, that people like to talk about General Marshall, the Marshall Plan and what happened in Europe after the war. And if you really want to know what happened, Marshall was a damn general. George Marshall was a general who was put over the State Department. And then when Reagan came to power, he chose another general, Hay, over the State Department. This is the time, of course, in Marshall. They had this serious contest that was going on with the Soviet Union. And when Reagan comes in and Haig is there, they have a revolution happening everywhere, particularly in the Americas. And this is when Haig, as a policy declaration, determined that none of them would be called freedom fighters anymore. They were all going to be declared terrorists. This is where the terrorists came into major play in this country. And now Tillerson, who is like putting Exxon over the State Department. I mean, it's all been so telling to looking at what happens in the State Department. It's got nothing to do with peace as opposed to the military intervention that the Pentagon is always looking to deal with. Now, what we've been watching with the Trump administration is, from my view, a reflection of this ongoing contest that we see happening with the electoral system in this country and most of what is called the West. What is really a contest between competing sectors of the ruling class for control of the state. I don't think it's ever been clearer than what we're seeing now. I mean, we've seen persons go to office, presidents get elected and what have you, and sometimes there's an old regime or remnants of the old regime still controlling really important aspects of the state. I remember when the Bush regime came in, George W. Bush, how his forces even create their own intelligence organization because they didn't trust the FBI and CIA. And you see this contest that's happening with Trump. Similarly, how everybody's so upset because Trump doesn't believe our own noble intelligence sources, rather depend on something else. And this whole contest about who's going to control them. I mean, you've got Flynn from National Security gone, Tillerson from the State Department's gone. And more you see this assault happening from elements of the bourgeoisie that controls some aspects of the U.S. state apparatus. And by state, I don't mean like State Department. I'm talking about the whole organization of coercion that is in play. And under Trump, we've seen this better than any place else. And not even from the moment when he was campaigning, when he was bragging about the fact that all of them, all the candidates were hired by big money and bragging about the fact that he's even purchased some himself in the past. I think this is the contest we're seeing and the crisis we're seeing and the attack on Flynn and the attacks, the Russian question, the attacks on Tillerson pushing him out is this contest that's happening within the bourgeoisie itself. That these are attacks that do not necessarily speak to the interests of the broad masses of people in this country or any place, and certainly not to African people. But it is a part of the crisis. And that's one of the reasons I think it's important that we learn how to intervene even in the electoral process. So on April 7th and 8th, the Black is Back Coalition will be having our electoral school. And we will impart as much as we can in terms of helping people to understand the nature of this beast that is the capitalist system, imperialism itself, and the electoral process. And that's going to be the 7th and 8th of April in St. Louis, Missouri. And I'm hoping that people will make it their business to get here because we need to fight this thing on all fronts.
That was Omali Yeshetela of the Black is Back Coalition.
The Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party is trying to take credit for the election earlier this year of Black radical lawyer Antar Lumumba to City Hall in Jackson, Mississippi, the overwhelmingly Black state capital. The new mayor is the son of Chukwe Lumumba, a former activist in the Republic of New Africa and founder of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, who was elected mayor in 2013 but died after only 8 months in office. His son, Mayor Antar Lumumba's name, is now closely associated with Bernie Sanders' Our Revolution organization and its wealthy contributors. Kelly Acuno was one of those that first suggested that Black activists in Mississippi run candidates for office. Acuno is a founder of the Malcolm X grassroots movement and of Cooperation Jackson, which seeks to form cooperative enterprises in the Black community. He wrote an essay in Black Agenda Report titled Casting Light, Reflections on the Struggle to Implement the Jackson Cush Plan. Acuno fears that some of his comrades have become too invested in simply winning elections rather than empowering the people and transforming society.
I think the movement here has won a couple of elections. Have we attained power? No. Was this the most direct means to build power? I would also argue no, despite what many people think elections in this country actually bring. You know, they don't bring power. They bring you, at best, a little bit of influence. You can manipulate a few rules here and there, depending on the scale of governance that you're operating within the system. But most of that really just entails deciding for most of these politicians which set of their friends is going to eat and who's going to pay the bill. The fundamental rules of the game, you don't transform within the system that we have claimed by the rules of the system. You know, that's a fundamental thing that I thought all of us understood walking into this situation. But I think as to this point, the pursuit of power through this vehicle has been less than stellar. Now, some of it has to do with time because, you know, remember, Chukwe Lumumba only was in office 8 months and Antar has only been in office about 6 months now. So it's still early in the game. But what's being called into question by myself is, what is the policy? What is the program? What is the orientation of sitting in these seats, acquiring these seats? What are you planning to do? What do people think is actually possible to do? And staying focused on that. And what I'm challenging is what I've said many times before and will say again, that I think we have to be very, very clear in the pursuit of these elections about what we think we realistically can do given the space, time, and conditions. And it's a clear choice that I think we have to make on the left between trying to be a good steward of the rules as they exist, which I think is a complete waste of time, you know, trying to do good governance, or are we pushing for transformation and dealing with all of the struggles and contradictions that that entails and the conflicts with the very system itself that it would entail. You know, and those are the questions I think that need to be asked. And if we think that we are not in a position to push the contradictions forward and to push the struggle forward, then I would argue it's no use wasting our time pursuing these offices. So if we're not prepared to push for transformation, we should be spending our time base building as best we can under the conditions and circumstances and limited resources that we have in our community. You know, we got to fortify our people, fortify the class. That is, I think, the first and foremost thing that we have to do. But we got to walk into these things clear. Otherwise, we'll be walking into what I keep calling and want everybody to clearly understand is a Syriza trap, which is in this case kind of deluding yourself into thinking that without the necessary force and without engaging in the struggle itself, that objective circumstances and reality is going to change by pure will of our personalities or pure will of influence. And influence is not power.
Let's clarify what you mean by the Syriza trap. You're referring to the Greek radical political party that wound up carrying out the neoliberal program of the European Union, which was the bankers' program, and actually putting it into practice in Greece, the very program that they were elected to resist.
That's right. And I think that is the serious trap that all forces who claim to be on the left have to confront right now. Given the nature of the balance of forces in the world, how they manifest on local, municipal, county, or parish, or national levels. And I think folks need to really look at that very critically. Are we prepared to really go to length? And clearly in the case of Syriza, it was a classic case of, you know, they talked left, but at all the critical junctures, they walked right. And they made every move to accommodate the dictates of finance capital. And then wind up using the argument that, well, we should, you know, when they call for that second round of elections after they encourage people to vote no, so it would have seemed, but only turn around to try to use the no vote against the austerity to reposition themselves to be in a better place to bargain with the Troika. And the Troika said, not only are we not going to bargain with you, we're going to make the deal worse than what we offered you the first time, which is what they did. And then they went back to elections. Under the guise that, well, look, you know, we can administer the cuts and the amputations better than the right can. And if that is our only position, be it in Jackson or be it any place else, if that is our only real thing that we have to offer to the people in terms of electoral politics or engaging the state in that manner, we need to leave that alone. Because what it ultimately winds up doing is it just engenders more disappointment, more frustration amongst the people, that the system can't change, and that those who keep talking about reform or revolution are all pretty much in the same category, in the same bag as the reactionaries that they know to be destroying their lives.
Very specifically in Jackson, the state of Mississippi is trying to deprive Jackson of sources of revenue, then impose an austerity regime, and the black administration of Jackson would be expected then to carry out this austerity program.
That's right. That's right. So for my part, before all of this piece even went public, was trying to make a case that, look, you know, if we do anything, we shouldn't run for mayor this go around, because the conditions were far worse than they were 4 years ago. The city's in debt. This neo-Confederate supermajority that sits in the state legislature had already advanced some very critical things that were choking Jackson off, not only from revenue, but also from any exercise of authority over critical parts of the city, creating, you know, little cities and little hamlets and bantustans within the city of Jackson itself, and usurping any and all kind of local autonomy or local authority, and that they're only poised to strengthen that by making advances on the water system, making advances for privatization on the school system, developing what's called like a one lake thing that they're going to flood a good portion if they have their way of downtown Jackson, creating a waterfront area to do gambling, to raise the property values, and more importantly, to gentrify large sectors of the black working class and displace tens of thousands of our folks, which ultimately changed the political equation that allows a kind of radical-like project like ours to even have life, to even have expression. And so my argument then was, look, we don't need to be in a position of trying to manage the contradictions of capital by being responsible for the governance or for its administration sitting in the mayor's seat, because given the kind of strong person form of government that Jackson has, that's ultimately what you do, right? And that where we could be most effective would be in the place of the city council. The city council here is not as, say, as strong as I think it should be, but it's not without some teeth, potentially, because what it ultimately decides is control over some aspects of the budget. And you could fight tooth and nail there against the austerity measures. So I thought that would be in a better place, because, you know, it becomes a real question. Do we have the strength? Have we built the strength in the community to resist the austerity? I would say, truthfully, we have not. I don't think we have the strength. I don't think we built that strength. in Jackson. And so, you know, to pursue the office when you know you don't have that strength winds up being a critical act of subjectivity, because it just relies on this notion that, again, I can administer the pain better than somebody else, and I might protect this or that. But the truth of the matter is, whether it's Tylenol or Buffering or whatever the situation is, you're still going to feel some pain. You know, that's not going to change. And so in our case, that's already started here to a certain extent in Jackson, with Antar having to try to make ends with the budget, you know, because our budget year starts in October. The fiscal year here in Jackson starts in October. And trying to balance the budget, because remember I said the city is in some debt, he moved to raise the property taxes and to implement a hiring freeze. Now, people will try to rationalize this off, well, these are the necessary steps you have to take, and this is what good governance looks like, and it's being fiscally responsible. But you're falling right into the trap of the neoliberal thinking and the imperatives that come with it by following that path. And so you're setting yourself up on a course to further administer austerity, because you don't have a clear and easy answer to how do you raise more revenues in the city. I think he's trying to present one, and his presentation is what I'm trying to comradely say, that is not the correct approach to take. You know, we don't need more corporations coming in here acting like Nissan clearly demonstrated is going to act, which is exploit the hell out of workers, repress them, deny any aspect of human dignity and democracy under the banner of just bringing more low-end jobs or middle-wage jobs to do development. We can do better than that. We got to do better than that. So it's a question of choices. It's a question of options. It's a question of how do we see the struggle proceeding and on whose terms. That's ultimately what's at question here, and what that piece, you know, Casting Light is trying to draw out for the world to kind of see, learn, and garner some understanding about, you know, if you're going to pursue some similar dynamics. And I hope people do. You know, I hope people everywhere are challenging for power, but to do so on clear terms, with clear strategy, a clear understanding of the forces that you're up against and what you are prepared to engage in, what you're prepared to put on the line to win.
And what you're advocating in defense and the people's defense against the austerity offensive that's coming down is the creation of a comprehensive food sovereignty program that would plant crops in every available vacant lot in Jackson.
That's one solution that I wanted to put out there to deal with and get people to understand, in this case, by implication, the nature of the threat. Because the truth is, and I think part of what the concern is of Antar and others, is that if we take some real revolutionary steps, the neo-Confederates are going to come down with a ton of bricks against the city. And are we prepared for that? And so that is saying, yes, they would. And it is upon us, it's incumbent upon us to be prepared and to get ourselves prepared. You know, we know that food is a weapon, always has been, likely always will be. And that we can take some step with the resources that we have, with the skills that already exist in the community, with things that don't take a great deal of capital infusion, and that we can start preparing a program of preparing ourselves to be food sovereign to a degree that enables us to have the strength to fight back. Because it's much easier to resist anything that these reactionaries are going to throw at us if we know we can eat, if we know we're going to be housed, if we know we're going to be clothes, right? And we know that to a certain extent we can build our capacity to give our people health care and other forms of security. So these are just some basic material things that I was just trying to say, that there are some things, even under the present conditions, that we can do to take more radical steps. But I think it takes a broader engagement of our imagination of what's possible to do it. And that's what I'm pushing for, trying to encourage the administration and others within the city to look at and take. Would it be an easy road? Absolutely not. It would be hard as hell. But again, I don't think we tried to get involved in this to take it easy.
The original Jackson Cush plan, which you were one of the authors of and was released in 2012, called for an independent political party that would express the will of people's assemblies that were being organized. And the goal was to construct socialism, largely through autonomous cooperatives that you would be organizing in Jackson. But what we have now, it appears, is a political organization in Jackson that is now claimed by the Bernie faction of the Democratic Party, about as far from being a black independent socialist party as one could imagine.
Yeah. You know, and I think there are a number of reasons for that. Probably too long to get into this interview. But I don't pretend to know what's in certain folks' heads. But I do know a little bit about strategy and a little bit about what options are presented to folks and how you deal with those options. And I can see from a certain perspective where a move like that makes sense, because I think many people think that by aligning with Bernie and aligning with the Democrats, A, you fortify yourself against your enemies by having, you know, more friends and more powerful friends, or at least the perception that you have some powerful friends, and that you could also put yourself in line through making that friendship and alliance and association. You could put yourself in line and the city in line to potentially garner more resources to deal with your problems, to deal with the debt, to deal with the infrastructure issues, and to try to draw in more businesses and more revenue. So it's a strategic choice. But what I think it says to a certain extent is that how you see the community and how you see your own power is that you see both as being very minimal. And that, to me, I think raises some serious long-term strategic questions, right? And the pursuit of the peace around the independent party was not for expediency, because nobody was under any illusion that given the strength and the monopoly of the Republicrats, that they were going to give up anything easy, and it was going to be easy to dislodge them in Jackson or any place else. So we knew that it was going to have to be a long-term fight and struggle, but that on the level of the capacity and scale to build something independent, we might have a real choice and a real option and capability to do that on a municipal level, build that base, and then from there, eventually grow this independent political force and this independent political party out. And this was drawn from experience that the organization was drawing from work that was being done in Alabama, that some of the members of Malcolm X grassroots movement in early 2000 actually worked to start a new party, the Freedom Party, primarily based out of Selma, and had did the work to get it on the ballot and put everything in place and actually ran some candidates. Now, they didn't win, but we garnered a lot of knowledge, experience, and skill from that, and thought the conditions were actually more favorable in Jackson to both scale that up and apply it in a place that we thought there was enough kind of work and dynamic history and credibility within the community that Chokwe and a few others could be viable candidates. Now, you know, would they win? Maybe, maybe not. You know, time would tell. But the point, again, as I raised in that essay, the point was to build power by building a base and using the process to ascertain information as to who believed in what we believed in, and through our efforts of reaching out to them directly, knocking on their doors, making the phone calls, you know, bringing them in, say, hey, you know, we've been looking for each other. Now let's connect and let's build something. And then having a 500 or 5,000 more people would be a qualitative gain towards building power. So that was kind of the long-term strategic aim and objective. And I would say that still needs to be pursued. And it's something I know I'm committed to doing despite all of the present challenges and limitations, because I think it still begs to be done to meet the nature of the challenges that confront our people, that confront humanity, and that confront the planet. I mean, we need a real alternative, and we need it fast.
And this essay is also an exercise in self-criticism. You lay out your principled objections to the way the movement has drifted, but you take responsibility for not having pointed out the contradictions and the pitfalls as they were evolving.
I've made many, many, many mistakes along this path, leading up to this path. Now, hopefully I'm learning from them. You know, that's the effort, just on the piece of a individual journey in this. Thankful to be in a position to try to make some course corrections and try to kind of undo some elements of things that I think have not been helpful, that have been problematic. Time will tell to what extent that's successful. But the main thing I think I can do, primarily with whatever level of audience that we've built, is at least try to offer some critical dialogue and some critical exchange for folks to think about these questions, however they may apply in your area, to not make the same mistakes. We got to this point not through just merely following our own actions, but trying to be revolutionary subjects, revolutionary actors. We've been studying the history of revolutionary engagement and practice the world over, at least that's how I was brought up, and trying to apply those lessons to the situation, be it where if I'm in Jackson or if I was in New Orleans or Oakland or Atlanta, and just trying to share and pass on that same type of information as those who had made critical contributions before me have done, that I could read and look at and draw upon to say, oh, this might work in this case. It's, you know, I would do this, or I'm going to try to avoid this particular pitfall. So that's what that's an effort in doing, because I hope for those who are out there now being inspired by Cooperation Jackson or being inspired by Antoine Lumumba or Chokwe Lumumba or the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the work that it has done and put in, you know, over the course of this time, that you continue to be inspired first and foremost just by the effort and the audacity to challenge our oppression, but that you learn some of the critical lessons from both the successes and the failures that we made to this point to not repeat them and have more success wherever in the world you might be at pursuing a revolutionary path.
And finally, let me ask you this question straight up. Anybody who reads the corporate media sees that the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party is claiming the victories of Antar Lumumba's electoral race as their own, as a Bernie
That's right.
Democratic uh-huh. victory. Is there any truth to that?
You know, I don't know if I'm in a position to answer that. What I will say, I don't know what Bernie brought to the equation with Antar's campaign. I really don't. I know, to my knowledge, they met, I think it was in March, at the rally for the Nissan workers that the UAW was in part responsible for putting on. I know they met there, and then I know for certain, as a fact, that he showed up at the Our Revolution piece, which is a Bernie front piece, in part, in June, and spoke on the platform, was given space to speak on the platform, knowing that that's an invitation-only space. So, you know, that speaks to some level of engagement, some level of direct correspondence and collaboration. So those are the only things I can point to per se as facts. Now, I know the Democrats appropriate any and everything they can from the left when they find it useful. And I know they would do that independent of Antar's will or independent of anybody's will. Now, the question, I think, for me is, and what I've been questioning, like that, if that's not true, where is the challenge to it? You know, that comes from him and might come from others to say, hey, stop appropriating my name in that regard or stop putting me in this enclosure that you're doing. And I haven't seen no efforts in that regard. So in that piece, one can draw your own conclusion. But the fact that they are doing this, I think, serves the narrative that Bernie and those who are hoping that Bernie is going to run again in 2020 are serving, and they want to tell the story that a social democratic approach is the right approach to take, that he can win, particularly here in the South, which most people, including the Democrats, have always written off or looked at as being suspect. And they want to tell that narrative in part because they want to give people hope. They want to encourage people to resist to a certain extent. But is the system changing resistance, or is the system affirming redirection? I would say that it's the latter. And it's something that we need to avoid like the plague, as far as I'm concerned, because we've seen this dead end trap time and time again, where the independent and autonomous motion of radical and progressive social movements wind up encapsulated within the Democratic Party and then narrowly channeled into policies that don't deal with the fundamental contradictions at play that are causing the misery. And we have to step beyond that, I think, ultimately as a social movement and folks who are contending with power, and understand that within the framework that's set up, you're not going to reform capitalism. And even what little twinks you might make are only episodic. Keynesianism was only really good for about a 30-year period under some very particular and special conditions that are not coming back, you know, unless they're going to go colonize some other people and planets and resources to offer another social imperialist bargain with. And I don't know that that exists anywhere. So that's a dead end road that I think we need to be clear in calling out, that the choices that were not made 50, 60, 70, 100 years ago, those contradictions are still with us, and we have to figure out a path to overcome them. We can't repeat the errors of the 20th century examples of socialism. By no means should we do that. We got to learn from those and try to come up with some new experimentation, some new methods of organizing, some new methods of exercising a real democratic practice, transform the overall system of production and reproduction, and avert the climate catastrophe and the sixth major extinction that cliff that we're heading down real fast. So we got some challenges ahead of us, and the Democratic Party, I don't think, is anywhere in the equation towards helping us meet those challenges.
That was Kelly Okuno speaking from Jackson, Mississippi.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has a new essay for Prison Radio. Abu-Jamal takes a look at the genocidal roots of the gun culture in the United States.
Historian Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is known best for her award-winning work, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, published in 2014. But lovers and readers of history know that she is a prodigious writer who has penned a considerable amount of history, much of it about what Americans have come to call Indian country. But her newest work is also groundbreaking, for she dares to attack the sacred text of the Holy Constitution and breaks down the forces and sources that has brought its Second Amendment, Weapons and Firearms Clause, into being. By so doing, she challenges her colleagues in the bright lights of history written before to make points how and why we consider the Second so special. She engages in the hidden history that made the Second so desirable and so powerful that it had to be hidden. From European landfall to today, she recounts that which is indisputable, that America is a creation of genocide, slavery, and mass death. From the first days of the emergence of Euro-America, Europeans sought to extinguish non-European life, Indians, Africans, others. The gun, far more than the Bible, made this so. Using archival and public sources, she excavated texts and tables to reveal the sources of something I've never heard of before that is a distinguished mark of America's deep martial roots, gun love. As a young woman, Dunbar-Ortiz writes, she was a member of a political collective that, during the 60s, armed themselves for self-defense. Soon, it became the central concern of her collective. Ortiz writes, it seems that our group and others in the years that the Vietnam War was playing out live on our televisions were in the vanguard of a trend of owning multiple weapons. Army and Navy surplus clothing accompanied this trend, which was soon replaced by sweatshop-produced camouflage garb to meet consumer demand. Something else was also at work. In Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, published by City Lights forthcoming, Ortiz journeys into untrodden ground, identifying that something else and the deep social forces that gave Americans special hunger for Indian lands, what Hitler and company called Lebensraum, living space. That land hunger was accompanied by the intense hatred against Indian people, and further, the monstrous African slave trade, all of which was done to enrich the wallets of white America. Loaded is a work of brilliance, of intense historical engagement, and of revelation of the America and how it came to be. She smashes the idols of mass worship of the gun and our idolatry of it by showing what truly lies beneath. She desacralizes the Second Amendment, casts it from the vault of heaven, and leaves it lying in the muck and mire, the blood, the hatreds that truly formed America.
That was Political Prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
After 6 years and a 500,000 deaths, the Syrian government and its Russian, Lebanese, Iraqi, and Iranian allies are finally winning the war against ISIS and other Islamic jihadist fighters backed by the United States. Only a very few Western reporters have actually covered the war on the ground. One of them is Vanessa Beely, a courageous British journalist who exposed the so-called White Helmets as nothing but a propaganda front organization for Al-Qaeda in Syria. Beely says the defeat of ISIS, mainly by the Syrians and Russians, has drawn together a peace bloc in the region, as opposed to the war bloc headed by the United States. Beely appeared on The Taylor Report, hosted by Phil Taylor, on radio station CIUT in Toronto, Canada. She said the U.S. is rapidly becoming isolated in the world.
And so now what we almost are seeing is Turkey and Qatar, although obviously, you know, there is an element of distrust within the axis of resistance against them, but nevertheless, they've really practically announced this military alliance, cementing the new resistance axis that includes China, Russia, Iran, so now Turkey, Syria, Lebanon. I mean, you know, these efforts by Saudi Arabia to bring division to Lebanon, of course, fueled by Israel. So now we have Turkey and Qatar basically joining the China, Russia, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq axis, which suddenly forms this very powerful bloc. And the problem is that what's happening now, I mean, Saudi's recent actions, which were intended to bring division to Lebanon, to drive wedges into what has been traditionally quite a sectarian society, and in reality it's had the opposite effect. It's actually brought together all of the political parties saying, no, you know, we don't accept this resignation. Hezbollah are coming forward, you know, with very clear indications that they know what is going on. They're talking about the potential of an assassination attempt on a key or prominent figure in Lebanon to try and revive sectarian difficulties. So Lebanon is suddenly gelling together against this external threat. And we're also seeing the same thing in Iraq, very interestingly. You know, Iraq, I mean, poor Iraq, you know, it's been the target of U.S. imperialism and destabilization for decades now. But we had a meeting very recently in Iraq with the leader of the PMU, Hashad al-Shaabi, which, of course, in the States is known as a terrorist organization. It's under terrorist sanctions. And yet the PMU now is a recognized organization, just as Hezbollah is in Lebanon, by the Iraqi administration. And the Iraqi army and the PMU forces have been fighting together, complementing each other as a defense force against externally backed, foreign-backed terrorist factions against Daesh. So we're seeing this coming together of previously divided factions under the U.S. imperialist pressure to fight the common threat, which is U.S. imperialism, you know, and that involves all of its client states in Israel and the Gulf states and so on. So we're seeing these attempts by Israel, by the United States, by Saudi Arabia to exacerbate any sort of sectarian fault lines. They're failing. And in fact, what's happening is that these nations are ensuring their own isolation. And what is happening is that the bloc itself is not only reinforcing, but it's actually drawing in other members that can see that if they're not careful, they're going to be left very much out on a limb with an ally that is not going to have their back. You know, the U.S. is not known for its...
Not terribly loyal.
But it's been a tremendous litmus paper for the world because it has exposed the United States for the dishonest, lawless rogue state that it really is. On an international stage, it has elevated Russia, although it is a pragmatic international player. It has nevertheless adhered to international law. It appears to believe in the supremacy of law. It has shown itself to be an honest international player. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you know, it's completely shifted the global paradigm. And what we're seeing, as I said, is this formation of a bloc behind Russia, and those basically almost deserting the sinking ship, which is the United States.
Yes, and by the way, that bloc is a peace bloc. I mean, they're actually trying to stop all these little fires and wars started by the U.S.
Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, he tweeted up in the last few hours, working with Turkish and Russian counterparts to build on ceasefire we achieved in Syria and preparing for inclusive dialogue among Syrians. The irony is that Saudi Arabia accuses Iran of destabilization while itself fuels terrorists, wages war on Yemen, blockades Qatar, and foments crisis in Lebanon. I can't say it any more clearer than that. You're absolutely right. It's the peace bloc versus the war bloc and versus the destabilization bloc. And, you know, I think most people now are recognizing that.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.